Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this is our first post 4th of July episode. Stone, how you doing?
I'm doing well. My recovery is coming along just fine. I had a little bit more than your average meal the other evening. I understand you got a chance to see some great fireworks, like really up close, yeah?
Yes, we did the Sandy Springs fireworks on July 3rd, and then we went downtown to the Centennial Park on July 4th. Both were really good.
Not to even be remotely compared, though, to the fireworks we're about to experience with our first guest this morning.
That's right. Good segue.
A little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to hear from Christina Beyer and a lady by the name of Alma. They're going to be talking about a gala that I definitely want our listeners to know about and encourage them to attend and support. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the founder, CEO, Grand Poobah of User IQ. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Mr. Aaron Acock. How are you, man?
I'm doing fantastic, thanks. How are you?
Good.
Now, User IQ, can you share a little bit about what you guys are up to?
Yeah. So, User IQ, our goal is to transform the way B2B SaaS companies communicate with their customers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, every customer
and
is...
SaaS, what is that?
SaaS.
It's like software. Sassy.
We like SaaS. Attitude.
Software as a service.
Okay.
So if you have software that's subscription-based, this is probably right. Going to be...
And that seems to be happening more and more.
That's right. Almost all software licensing models are moving towards a subscription base.
Right. And that's a big change, right? Back in the day, they would send you CDs and you'd have to get new CDs every year or so.
That's right. Or install locally.
Right.
Right. And so now, one of the benefits of SaaS is that you always have the latest and greatest.
Right. It's keeping it updated kind of in real time as it happens.
That's right. Right. And there aren't huge capital outlays at the beginning of an agreement with a software provider either. Right. You can just do it month by month.
And it's an easy in and out, right?
That's
like you can quit anytime usually and there's
that's
no
right.
penalty.
Yep.
So that's what's the landscape. And yours, is yours one of those also? Yours is
we have the same model. So we're a B2B SaaS company selling to B2B SaaS companies.
And then your service, though, that you're offering is to help those SaaS companies just be better at what they're doing?
Exactly right. Yeah, so here's the visual I want you to picture. So for B2B SaaS companies on the marketing side, they've always had this marketing funnel.
Right.
Right. And so they at the top of the funnel, you have leads that you're attracting to your site.
Right.
And then you nurture and qualify them and then you close them.
Correct.
Right. And that's typically the last step in that marketing.
The
funnel.
Closing
the
part.
The closing, right?
That's
but for
kind
B2B
of an important
SaaS,
part,
it's a
right?
huge, it's a really important part.
But it kind of gets, they diminish the value because it's at the bottom. Right.
Right. Well, or they consider it, yay, we won, we closed the deal and we're done.
They're done, right.
But for B2B SaaS companies in a subscription model, it really isn't the end. In fact, it's just the beginning.
Right.
You need to retain those users and expand their account usage. And you want them to be raving fans so they tell their friends about you.
Because I'm going to get an email the next day, the next week, the next month of a competitive piece of B2B SaaS software that maybe I'm going to look at and I'm going to reflect back on what is the value that I've gotten, what's the communication, what's the relationship, all that.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. Yeah. And software, as you mentioned, has fundamentally changed. So it's almost like B2B SaaS companies have to win every month.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so to do that, they really need their customers to be successful and get value as soon as possible when they sign up and start using the product.
And then so how does your service help them do that?
So we want to guide each user to success in the product. And that's different for every user, right?
So every user software is different.
That's right. And every user is at a different stage in the customer journey. So for example, a new user that's starting to use your product today for the first time ever might need a guided tour.
Right.
Versus a regular user that's ready for an upgrade might need to know about a new feature that you've just released.
Right.
Or for a veteran user, you might want to gather some feedback from them in the form of an NPS survey, a Net Promoter Score survey.
Right.
And you want to deliver that after they've done something important. Intuit is famous for this by delivering NPS surveys, not while you're filling out your TurboTax online form, but after you've submitted your return. That's when it's most important to understand what your experience was like using the product.
And then so you have kind of triggers that occur throughout the life cycle of the customer certain activities, you know, you kind of ping them with certain surveys or certain kind of reminders or upsells?
All of those things. So user IQ, that's the deep user intelligence that we're delivering. So we understand who each user is and can show you who they are and how they're behaving and what they need to be successful next. But we don't just tell you what they need. We can actually help you deliver that. So we can deliver guided tours to new users who just signed up. We know that they're new. We know they haven't seen the tour. We know they haven't performed specific functions in the product. So we can deliver the tour to them, but deliver a different type of announcement to a regular user.
But you can also be proactive to kind of get ahead of a potential problem. Like say they signed up, but they haven't turned it on in 3 days or something.
Absolutely. So we have a lot of that just built in that automatically works. So we've got these things that we call magic segments. You've got your active users that are signed up and logging in every day and doing exactly what you would love for them to be able to do. But then you've got these users that are at risk. Maybe they signed up a couple of weeks ago. They used to log in every other day or so, but you haven't seen them for a couple of days, right? And so now what you want to do is make sure that they're getting the value out of the product that you need them to get.
So this strikes me as something you really probably have to be good about eating your own cooking. So you need to be demonstrating this all along with your own SaaS product.
That's right.
So you're doing all these things yourself. You are a walking, talking, breathing model of what you want them to do, yeah?
That's right, yeah. And we're trying to get better at this every day. You've heard the phrase, the cobbler's children have no shoes. Sure. This is something that we continually try to get better at every day. So we're delivering guided tours in our own product and helping to gather a lot of deep user intelligence about our own customers.
That's now, when you're using your own service, are there things that you're like, wow, that's not supposed to happen for us? Like, do you catch things that you're able to implement?
So I'm on the engineering side. I see everything. Have you ever painted a room
and you see every flaw?
Yeah,
that's how I am. So we are continually trying to improve the product. We have a very agile process. So we release updates to the product several times a week.
Now, is there something that you found that maybe surprised you that you didn't anticipate, that the users do things kind of in a different manner than you anticipated or your clients maybe anticipated, and you have to kind of make a pivot?
Yeah, absolutely. This is true probably for most software development shops. When you actually watch a user walk through the product and use it in front of you, we'll do user testing sessions where we watch someone with fresh eyes go through the product. They do things completely different than the way that you would do it.
Completely different. Like, what's an example of something that you said, well, as soon as they're going to get to the page, they're going to click that big red button, but in actuality, they click a yellow button that's on the left.
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, is it something that dramatic?
It can be. It can be, right? And so that's part of the magic of user IQ. You can quickly understand what your users are doing in your product, or maybe things that they might be missing.
Right.
You might have just released a brand new feature that you know they're going to love, and nobody sees the big red button in the top right corner. What we can do is, if they haven't seen or clicked through that big red button in a couple of days after logging in, we can direct them to it, right? We can draw attention to it with what I call a little a sonar ping, which is a very subtle way to call attention to it. Mm-hmm. Or we can darken the background of the screen and point to it in a tour step that says, click here. Yeah.
Now, do things because I've seen this debated, like pop-ups, like people who use pop-ups say, oh, they work great. And then every user goes, I hate pop-ups.
That's right. Yeah, we hate pop-ups as well. What people hate about pop-ups is that they are like carpet bombing, right? Everybody gets the pop-up.
Right.
You've seen this pop-up where you're trying to leave a website.
Right, and they're like, and not yet. Up, right.
Like, so everybody's getting that. Our in-app announcements, we don't say pop-ups, by the way. Okay. Our in-app announcements.
So when you call it something else, then people don't get mad about
it. No, our in-app announcements are highly targeted, right? Mm-hmm. We've got a customer that has over 7,000 users, and they'll launch a campaign that's targeted at 7 of them, right? So it's very targeted. And you can use a lot of different types of data to target those users. Their activity level, how often they're coming in, which account they're a part of. We can even pull in data from other sources like Salesforce. We've got a customer that launched a campaign for all of their European customers that fall under a certain tax rule in the UK, and they have not performed this action in 3 days. It's very targeted.
So I got to ask you what the backstory, the Aaron Aycock backstory. How did all this get started? What were you doing before you started going down this path?
You had a bad SaaS experience.
In a way, I did. Yeah. Before User IQ, I was CIO for a travel tech company headquartered here in Atlanta. Yeah.
That must have been miserable.
No, it was fantastic. It was a great team. Loved every bit of it. We had a great marketing team. It was a company called TRX. We had a great marketing team that could tell us who was coming to our website, who was signing up for webinars, who was downloading white papers. When those customers became actual paying customers, the craziest thing happened. We actually lost a lot of visibility into who they were and what they needed to be successful. Now, think about that. We had all of this data leading up at the top of the funnel from our marketing automation tools. Right. Then they start using our product. And at this point, we should have mountains of data
right.
over, you know, who they are and what sure. they need to be successful. But it was really hard to get to that data because it was spread out in a lot of different silos. So we had
so silos happen in companies
still to this day. Wow. Amazingly enough,
people aren't good at sharing information,
right? And sometimes they're just technical hurdles. So right. I was CIO over some of these data silos myself, right? And so, in one particular example, we found that we had a web application and a native mobile app to go along with it. And the web application was great. People liked it. But we found if they used the native mobile app in conjunction with the web app, they loved it. They stayed. Yeah. Right. And so it was an easy decision for us. Let's launch a campaign targeted at the folks that are using just the web application that may not know about the native app.
Right.
Give them an announcement and a link to go download the app. Simple, right? My team owned the BAs that would run the reports to figure out who that would be. I owned the dev teams as well and the systems teams that would deploy it. All we needed was creative input from the marketing team. So I'm thinking this is probably going to be like a 2-week project.
Yeah, right. Sure.
Easy, right?
Yeah.
Now, a couple months later, we're still talking about, hey, when are we going to roll this campaign out? And so at that point, it was one of those thoughts that there's got to be a better way. And right. I wanted something that was as simple as posting a blog on WordPress, right? Just pick your message, pick your target audience, and deploy. And so that was the seed that eventually grew into what would become User IQ. And so now we say what used to take days or weeks now takes just minutes.
Okay, but hold on. I think we've missed a major piece here. You went home and you told Honey Bunch, you know, I got this great job. I've been bringing home a pretty good check, and we're not going to do that anymore. I'm going to go build this thing. How did that go?
So TRX, this was a long time in the making, as you can imagine. TRX was acquired by a company called Concur, a large SaaS company in the Northwest. And Concur was eventually acquired by SAP. So during that acquisition, that was a really good point of time to make the exit. So I told my wife when I went home that
you know it's important to get your stakeholders involved in major decisions.
That's
like
right.
This. So as this, a CIO, this, you should know that.
That's right. So this is where the stakeholder meeting comes into play. So I go home, and my wife and I have been talking about this for a long time. We talk about all this stuff. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to take some time off. I'm going to take at least 6 months after this deal and just, you know, prepare and get ready. And she tells me now that she never believed me that I was going to last 6 months just taking it easy. Because 6 weeks later, I was working on the prototype for User IQ. And so later that year, a couple months later, we were demoing the prototype, and we raised our initial seed round of funding from investors here in town. So BIP, BLH, and we were the first investment for TechSquare Ventures.
Now, did you already know how to go about that, or was that a whole new?
Entirely new world.
I'll bet it was.
Entirely new world.
How much fun was that?
It was actually a lot easier than I expected because I was prepared for it to be miserable. But it wasn't.
Haven't we had the TechSquare Ventures guy, Patton?
Blake Patton?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
He's a good guy.
We love Blake.
So now, did you only look for funding here in town, or did you look elsewhere as well?
We did. We didn't look outside of town. We raised what we needed to locally.
And you found that it was a receptive audience, that there was, at least they would hear your story.
Very. Yep. Yeah. It was actually, it was a pretty easy process. So I mean, I'm not saying that there weren't times where I was going crazy, wondering why does it take so long? But it turns out after talking to every entrepreneur I've ever spoken to that's raised funding since, I said, yeah, I had no idea it was going to take as long as it did once the process began.
Right.
So,
and because it's a different job, right? Raising money is a different job than building the business.
Yeah, it's almost like you should swap out your business cards.
But Acres of Diamonds may be in this region, right? There are plenty of SaaS companies that it should at least be entertaining work right here in our backyard.
That's
right?
Absolutely
true. Do you know about how many B2B SaaS companies are in Atlanta?
A lot.
Is it hundreds or thousands?
Thousands. And here's why. So one of the questions that we answer regularly is, well, how many B2B SaaS companies can there be? First of all, just on their own, B2B SaaS companies alone, there are a ton. It's hard to say how many because it's growing so fast.
Right, and not all of them are officially funded. They could be under the radar, right?
That's right. But what's exciting for us is you don't necessarily have to be known as a B2B SaaS company to be somebody that we can help. So you've got Fortune 500 companies out there that are building software products, and it's behind an authenticated login, and they treat it just like a B2B SaaS company. So really, any company out there that is building software, whether that's their main line of business or not, we can help them. Even if it's a Fortune 100 company that's rolling out an intranet site, and they want to make sure that their employees are engaged on this site that they've spent $100 million rolling
out. Right, so it could just be an internal thing and still has benefit your service.
That's right. Yeah, so our target market is pretty big. Anybody that's building software is in our target market. If you've got an authenticated login and you want customers to be engaged with what you've built, you're in our target market.
Now, when you do have something that appeals to so many different groups, how do you kind of prioritize your time and effort in terms of marketing to them?
Yeah, so we did have to apply filters to this. Otherwise, you could go in just about any direction. So we typically look for companies that are of a certain size. You know, they've got perhaps a customer success team, you know, so now they're investing in making sure.
So you're looking, that's kind of meets the profile. If they have a team that's for customer success, at least philosophically, they'd be open to something like
this. Right, customer success. If they've got a product marketing team. So this is a team that would focus inward. This is a prediction that UserIQ is making for the next couple of years. We think if a company has a marketing team, and the majority of them are focused outwards. Let's say they've got 7 folks on their marketing team. In most companies, almost all 7 are going to be focused on the top of the funnel, looking outwards. Mm. For B2B SaaS companies.
So they're like doing the prospecting. They're just trying to just get more
qualified leads and move them into a marketing qualified lead so the sales team can take it over. We think in a couple of years, that's going to seem crazy that you would have a marketing team of 7 and not have at least 1 or 2 folks.
What do you think the good ratio should be?
Probably about half, depending on the life cycle of the company, later in your life cycle.
So what's an average spend like on software as a service?
Ooh, that's a tricky question.
Like some things are $50 a month, some things are $5,000 a month.
Yeah, if you use Salesforce.com, you're spending a lot more than $50 or $100 a month as well. Hundreds and could be thousands of dollars.
But where does your service come into being a benefit? Like what's the minimum amount or that's not part of the criteria for you?
Not necessarily.
No, if they have enough volume, then it doesn't matter.
Exactly right. For example, we've got a great customer here in town who is probably should be categorized as a B2C company, but they treat their business very much like a B2B. So they've got a subscription-based business model, and they look at things like retention and churn and account expansion and things like that. So even though they're B2C, they're a great customer for us, and their subscription rates aren't that expensive, right? It's $20 per person per month, but there's enough volume flowing through that it makes a lot of sense to optimize the success for each one of those B2C customers.
Well, I'll tell you one pattern that we see pretty often, and execs are pretty open about talking about it, but in a lot of organizations, the sales team and the marketing team don't always play real well together. And I sense that having something like your service would help them play better together. Is that an accurate read?
I think so. I think having data and visibility into what's going on in the customer journey always helps.
Do you find that true, that sales and marketing don't always see eye to eye on the objectives?
You know, I read about this a lot. I haven't seen it. I haven't experienced it myself.
With your customers or in
prior roles even. So I've always seen the marketing team working well with the sales team. But there are clear lines of demarcation. That that bottom of the funnel where the handoff goes to the sales team and then the marketing team goes back to focus outward.
Right.
I've seen that quite a bit. And that's typically the right thing to do. But again, for a B2B SaaS company, if you look at the math of how this works, after about years three or four, your existing customers become more important in retaining and expanding account usage than new deals won.
Yeah,
and if you don't
respect
that and have a plan for that, then it's going to be a tough road. And we call that, by the way, we call that customer growth. So if you think about this funnel, we think it shouldn't be a funnel at all. We think it's more like an hourglass. And so the next steps for a B2B SaaS company after the close is retention, expansion, and referral. And UserIQ wants to be the technology platform that powers that. A lot like marketing automation powered the top of the funnel.
So we got a chance to meet by virtue of this platform and having you come in and share your story. But if we got on your radar because we have authenticated login, we have contributors out in different markets, mm-hmm. and they have like a back door that only they can go play in this little piece of real estate within our system to submit stories, and we process their audio and all of that stuff. What would your sales process look like? How do you go about having the sales and marketing conversation with a prospective client?
So we are very targeted ourselves, as you probably would expect. It depends on what you're looking to do. So we typically will be introduced to one of three departments at a company, either the customer success team, the product marketing team, or the product management team. And each of those three groups has slightly different goals and what they want to accomplish. So we'll tailor what we do based on your role, but those roles will also include their colleagues on our demo call. So we'll start what's important to you. For example, if you're a customer success team, you might be interested in a dashboard of account health. Show me all of my yellow and red customers because I've only got time to look at 10 accounts today. Which 10 should I look at, right? And so that might be the starting point. But they'll invite the product management team who may want a better understanding of usage within the product. Well, we can help with that too. So we'll include that in the demo. And if you're wanting to guide users to a new feature, for example, if you've been working for 6 months on a new release and you're really excited about it, you launch it and nobody shows up, we can help with that too, right? We can let folks know, the folks that haven't seen it yet, we can let them know about it. And we don't just give them an announcement, a pop-up. We actually take them into the feature and show them how to start using it.
So demo call, you get on the phone or mm-hmm. some sort of WebEx-y thing?
Yeah, we do GoToMeeting. It's very easy. It takes about 30 minutes to do the demo.
And then, so it's an experiential kind of sales process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We walk through, you know, for the first 5 minutes, we just want to get a better understanding of what you're trying to accomplish. You know, customers might say, well, we've been doing NPS surveys for some time and we get 3-4% response rates. Can we improve that? And our answer to
that
is...
that the typical pain point? Is that the initial point of entry usually, that they're not satisfied with their net promoter score?
No, that's one of the examples. It really could be anything. They could want a better guided tour for new users. They could want an NPS survey.
But when you're kind of positioning the ROI of this, are you saying like, look, if we keep your client another 2 months, this pays for itself? Like, is that how you frame it in terms of ROI?
The math ends up working that way. You know, if we typically, the types of customers that we sell into, if we can save one or two churn accounts, it typically.
So you can add up to the lifetime of the customer.
That's right.
Which you probably have data that supports that.
That's right. Yeah, churn is probably the hardest data point to calculate because it can happen for so many different reasons, but that's also why you want better visibility into what's going on. And so it really, the starting point for our conversation can be anywhere, but it almost always eventually leads to, well, how do we make sure that the customers are successful so that they stay longer, right? And we're not about, let's get every dollar we can of the customer. We're about, let's make every customer as successful as possible because everything else takes care of itself.
Right.
So yeah. Before we went on air, you asked me who is sponsoring this episode or the series or this show. And I told you, well, we have a lot of sponsors across the network and I didn't really have an answer, but I've made a command decision while we're talking here. Yeah. So the sponsor of this episode has now become the Business Writers Exchange Conference that we're doing up in Brasstown. But I mentioned that because I want to know, I mean, you seem like a pretty knowledgeable guy. Is there a book in you? Do you think at some point you might author a book? Any aspirations along those lines?
I would love to write a book. I am a very slow writer. So anytime someone on my team sends something for review and editing, it is stuck in my inbox for a couple of days
because
I just want it to be perfect.
So maybe someday, though, you might decide to write a business book and share some of this knowledge. So, but leading up into that, do you find yourself reading and or trying to capture some thought leadership? Do you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I read everything I can.
Yeah.
So in this space, there are actually a number of books that you can get into and start to get a feel for what's about to happen.
I want your book to come. I want the ACOC Advantage.
All right. Well,
you can have that title there.
I'll join you at the Business Writers Conference right. And get a draft going.
All right. So let's give him a quick shout out. It's our buddy Jack Phillips with the ROI Institute. And of course, he has written and helped folks write, I don't know how many hundreds of books.
Probably 50 books himself.
Well, and he brings like a half a dozen every time he comes to the studio. He was in the studio last week. We have formed a strategic partnership and we're going to do a lot of neat stuff together. We're going to do a live broadcast up here at this Business Writers Conference. And it is July 25th through the 30th. They've got a pre-conference workshop, the 25th through the 27th. The conference is the 27th through the 29th. And then they've got post-conference workshops, July 29 and 30. Brasstown Valley Resort and Spa is where we're going to be staying, and we've got some press releases and other announcements coming out. Jack on the air said that Business Radio X friends and family get a nice 20% break on this. I think we've got a release coming out in Daybook in the next day or so. So that's going to be fun stuff.
Right. The website is business-writers-exchange.com.
And now our producer knows he has to add all this information to the post for the archive of this episode that we've done today. But no, it's not at all uncommon for us to talk to business leaders
who
you can just tell they have one or more books in them, and it can do a lot to genuinely serve your ecosystem, your customer base, and it's a heck of a sales and marketing tool, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to. I think that even though we've seen SaaS business models for years now, we're in early innings here.
Right.
And there's so much more to learn, which is very exciting for us.
And then after the show, I'll tell you a shortcut to help you write your book.
Yeah, we do have a shortcut, which is part of what we're talking to Jack about, too.
Right.
As well. All right. How can our listeners reach out, have a conversation with you, someone on your teams, maybe set up one of these demos? What's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, very easy to do. You can just go to our website. It's useriq.com. Very easy to sign up for a demo. Again, it only takes 15, 30 minutes. And we can do it over GoToMeeting, so we can do it anytime. And very easy to do. We also offer a free trial. So you can get started and use it for 14 days. And here's something that I would offer to the listeners. If you've ever run an NPS survey before, you should try us for 14 days and run an NPS survey in your product. And here's why. Uh-huh. If you've done this via email before, you're probably used to 2 or 3% response rates on this. And the response from email NPS surveys is very bipolar in that, imagine it, like it makes sense. If you've got an NPS request in your inbox, there's only one of two reasons you're probably going to take the time to respond to it. You either love it or you hate it.
Right.
When we deliver an NPS survey in the moment in the application, based on something that we call a zero moment of truth, you've done something important, it's very targeted, we know exactly who we're delivering the survey to, we get response rates of between 40 and 60%. That's 40 to 60%. We've got a survey that has upwards of 70%, and this is with thousands of responses.
Wow.
So you get a view that you've never had before of your user base. Then this is, in an NPS world, very important because it's the middle ground. It's the passives, the ones that are just on the edge of being promoters. And if you could understand what makes them tick and what they need to be successful, it could be a fundamental change for you in your business. So that's what we would offer. Try us for a couple of weeks. And when you do, launch an NPS survey. It's pretty easy to do.
Fantastic. Okay, so useriq.com. Is
Useriq.com. That's the best way to reach us.
All right. Well, it has been an absolute delight having you in the studio this
Likewise.
Morning, man.
It's been fun.
Yeah, it beats the heck out of working, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, can you hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to start on my notes for my next book, but I'd love to join.
Here, you can read the brochure till we get Alma in her group. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, we have with us, we actually have Christina Beyer with us as well, who set all this up. So we're going to get a chance to visit with her as well. But the rock star, you know, the headliner that we brought in for you today is the CEO with the Alma G. Davis Foundation. What a coincidence, Alma G. Davis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Alma, can you share a little bit about what you guys are up to?
Sure. With the Alma G. Davis Foundation, our whole goal and mission is to educate, empower, and celebrate survivors of domestic violence and help them to get back on self-sufficiency and economically sufficient. So through the foundation, we just finished up our 7th annual Dinner for Divas Gala that was here in Atlanta at the Cobb Energy Performing Arts Center, actually a week and a half ago on June 25th, where we honored almost 200 women and young girls starting at 13 years old that all live in domestic violence shelters across the state of Georgia. It was a fantastic turnout, as we also honored the Fulton County Assistant DA, April Ross, who unfortunately, in 2014, she filed for divorce from her husband, who was and they were both in a domestic violence situation, and he ended up shooting her. And she is paralyzed, and he committed suicide. But she is now for Fulton County, heading up their whole domestic violence, component. So we got to honor her as well. So it was just a pleasure to see so many people come out and support and realize, see all these shelters across the state of Georgia and support their survivors. So we just finished up on that, but we are still in full gear. We have two major things coming up here in Atlanta on August 25th with Northside Hospital. Northside has partnered with us, as well as Chick-fil-A Foundation, to provide free. You can come into at the Georgia World Congress Center, and if you're a survivor of domestic violence, whether it's male, female, child, you can get tested for 25 different things for free. Because most people don't realize how bad your health is affected when you are a survivor of domestic violence. So whether you're having sleep apnea problems, PTSD, hearing problems, you can get tested for all those things for free. And so we are elated to be able to offer that to the public on August 25th. And then again, on October the 1st, we're doing our third annual Walk a Mile in Their Shoes walk here in Atlanta, highlighting domestic violence and having survivors come out, as well as the community. And with that walk, it's a 5K run, 1 mile walk. The walk was done specifically for me because I'm not a runner. But if you come out that day and you walk instead of run, you're partnered with a real survivor, whether that's a male or a female or a child. And as you walk together, they share their story with you. So you're truly walking a mile in their shoes. But it opens it up, the conversation, for communities to talk about domestic violence, for people to come out and say, hey.
Because we don't talk about it.
We don't talk about it.
In general, do we?
No, but it's around us 24/7. We some kind of a way systematically ignore it. And it's hard to ignore when statistics show 1 out of 4 women and 1 out of 7 males are domestic violence victims, but only 5% is reported. So if the real actual numbers were reported, we're probably looking at 1 out of 2 women or 1 out of 4 males, but we just don't talk about it.
1 out of 4 males. I would have never even on my radar. Are there some precipitating events or conditions that we see patterns? Like if these things are happening in a family's life, the likelihood of domestic violence is higher, or is it just all over the board? It occurs to me it could be money. Financial pressure seems like it would be one of those contributing factors.
Finances are the number one reason why people stay in domestic violence situations.
That's why they stay.
That's why they say financial control.
Oh, okay.
Because they have the lack of. Or even if you are making it. And again, it's not a social economical, it's not a specific demographics, because you have it all over the board. But your finances are being controlled by the abuser. So whether you're the breadwinner or not, you don't have access to that capital, to those funds. You are stuck in that situation because there's so much going on. So there's before you get to the physical, there's the mental abuse, there's the verbal abuse. Like I said, the control component of it, and then it relays into the finances, into the physical. So we see it all over the board, and it affects so many different areas. Ways that people don't talk about domestic violence, even how it affects corporations. Over $5.8 billion was lost last year due to domestic violence out of corporations. $4.1 billion was due to direct medical and healthcare costs that corporations are actually paying out on employees because they're in domestic violence situations. So the medical bills, the bills that the corporation is being responsible for, and then $1.8 billion was lost in productivity. If you're not at work and you're out because of this situation, my company is losing money. So it affects all over the board. And it's our mission to educate people to understand this is just not a hush-hush situation that if I don't see it, it's not affecting me. It affects everybody. Even down to foster care, 65% of kids that are taken are in foster care are due to they were taken out of domestic violence household.
Wow. That is a scary number.
Now, is there any, if you're in a relationship, are there any kind of telltale signs that maybe this could turn into a domestic violence situation?
Yes. One of the first signs we see is alienation. You begin to start getting pulled away from family and from friends. Mm-hmm. You're made to feel like it's just you and that person. And you don't need anybody else. But that's one of the control mechanisms that the abuser uses. So
the victim is kind of going, oh, look, they think I'm special. Or
absolutely. Right, like, absolutely. They want me all for themselves.
But that's really a warning sign.
That is, because in a healthy relationship, most people want, if it's a positive, wants your input, wants your family around. They want to be accepted by family and friends. So that is a telltale sign. Little small things that we see if you're with someone and how do they handle anger? You know, do they curse you out? Do they punch walls? Do they threaten your children? Do they even pick on animals? All of those are telltale signs of the levels of abuse and how they will rise. So often we see survivors don't pay attention to the red flags. And again, a part of our mission to educate is to teach people, not just the survivor, on how to educate and get yourself back out there and not repeat the situation, but as a family member, as a community member, how can you get engaged when you see it going on? What should you do to try to help intervene? Violence begets violence. And I'm a strong, strong, strong believer from the violence that we see out in the streets every day. That's a learned behavior. They learned it from somewhere. And most of the time it's from what happened behind closed doors.
Now, can you share a little bit about your story? You started out as an entrepreneur and then kind of moved into this role as an advocate?
Yes. Sadly enough, I am a survivor enough. I am a survivor. The sad part is that I had to go through it, but I had to go through that to get to where I am today to help other people to understand what that feels like. I was a child. I saw it every day at home. And so that became my norm. That's what I was taught. That is how you deal with issues and problems. So at 14 years old, I had my first set of black eyes at 14.
Ouch.
From another 14-year-old boy. That's what he saw at home every day.
Right.
So the resources weren't there. You're still a child. You're told whatever you deal with, you deal with that privately. You don't put your business out in the street. And so that became our pattern of behavior because that's all we knew. It wasn't until I was 23 years old, I had my first daughter, and I said, you know, there's no way my child will, this is not functional. There has to be other ways that we can disagree, understanding how to disagree and be taught that. And so I made it my personal mission to go out and help so many other people because that's not what we knew. That's not what, and so it became my personal passion. And so almost 12 years ago, the foundation was started by myself. And, initially, when I started, I was working with a lot of athletes and going in their communities, looking at what their needs were. It wasn't so much focused on the domestic violence side. It was going in these low-income areas and saying, okay, they need health care or they need education. But no matter where we went, I kept running into the violent side of it. You kept seeing that platform, no matter what demographics we went into, that this was underlining. And because I was a survivor at such a young age, I said, you know, let's shift this foundation and let's focus on those because it is affecting everybody. It is affecting every arena. And so that's how I got started. And I'm stuck.
So Christina Beyer, you're the one that reached out to us and said, hey, you guys, you got to share this story, maybe recap the event, talk about new events. How did you get into Alma's circle?
Well, so I have a background in nonprofit management, association management, and event planning, actually. So domestic violence is something that is near and dear to my heart as well. And I was introduced to Alma. And since this was something that was important to me, you know, I reached out and kind of said, hey, let me help you out, not just with the gala, but just overall, let me see what I can do to help you and to further the mission. Domestic violence is not just one look. You know, it's not just men against women. It's not just women that are affected. You have violence against children. You have violence against men. Yes. You have violence against elders. You know, you have so many different types of violence, and it's really important to get the message out there. So I kind of threw myself at Alma and said, let me help you in whatever way I can. And that's kind of how we got here.
But your day job is to help nonprofits with events and put on galas and raise money and things like that.
Yeah, well, I'm actually Women in Technology's director of events. So that is my full-time day job.
And we mesh all that together.
Absolutely.
So under our education, when we say educate, so it's not just educating the community, it's educating survivors on, okay, why are you in this situation? Let us give you all the tools you need so that you don't go back.
Absolutely.
So for instance, we take in corporations, and we teach like Xerox came in, brought their whole HR department in, and they taught, okay, how do you set up LinkedIn for people to really pay attention to you? What's legal for you to answer in an interview? People don't know that component of it. So we're giving them all the tools they need to retain jobs, to get jobs, to have their own finances, whether that means understanding your credit score. When you get finances, how do you save them? How do you invest so that you're not controlled by somebody else that's controlling your finances? And then we turn around and empower them by getting them jobs with our partners. So I'm one of those people that say, let me call you to the red carpet. If you're going to say you want to help and you send out, let's say your company and you send your employees out, well, now get a return on your investment. Give the same people that are taking your trainings, give them an opportunity. That's all they need. They're in these situations not because they want to. It may be, again, because they didn't know better. And give them a job, give them an opportunity to work at your job, whether that's 1 week, whether that's 6 months, but make sure you're seeing a return on your investment so that we are making sure that they're not going back in. And so that's a great way that we partner with corporations, with looking for additional partners like through Women in Technology to help our women and our girls and our men get these stable jobs so that they're not going back to domestic violence.
So next up for you, what's the next event? Is it the run?
No, it's August 25th. It is the healthcare. It's called After Domestic Violence, Becoming a Healthy You Physically and Financially. So there'll be financial training, financial investors on there. The hospital will be there to help you understand physically your health component, how that's meshed. And then not even a month later, we're kicking it off with the walk. It's actually October 1st. And October is National Domestic Violence Month. So we'll be kicking the walk off for National Domestic Violence Month.
And then if somebody wanted to learn more, is there a website?
Absolutely. It's Alma. It's a long website. Alma G. Davis Foundation.org. That's AlmaGDavis Foundation.org. And they can connect with us on social media. We are on Facebook, Alma G. Davis Foundation, Instagram, Twitter, Alma G. Davis FDN. So we are out there.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being a guest today.
Thank you.
And thank you, Aaron, as well. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.